You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here today for our weekly lunchtime talk. Now, we're very lucky to have both Lawrence Cockcroft and Anne-Christine Wegener with us today. Lawrence Cockcroft was a key player in establishing Transparency International in the UK, and his extensive work with them has included initiating its programme on corporate codes of conduct, launching work to combat corruption in the defence sector, and promoting the UK Bribery Act, which has become the basis for a series of cases in transnational corruption brought by the UK's Serious Fraud Office. His co-author is Anne-Christine Wegener, who is a political scientist and anti-corruption expert based in Frankfurt. She works with Germany's International Development Cooperation Agency, GIZ, and was previously the Deputy Director and Programme Manager at Transparency International alongside Lawrence. They join us today to outline why corruption is still a very real problem in the West, and given the events of the last month or so, I'm sure you can agree that we need their expertise now more than ever. And I think they have a book to talk about as well. So, Lawrence, over to you.
Thank you very much, Matthew, and thanks for inviting us here. We're going to talk about corruption in the West, defined as corruption in Europe and North America. And our argument is and is going to be that that form of corruption is a reality which is frequently ignored by all kinds of people in governing circles as being rather inconvenient, but actually does determine many outcomes. And it varies in its nature, but and we'll discuss even in the next 20 minutes how those variations really operate. I think it's fair to say that while, if you'll forgive my using the word elite for a moment, rather overused word, while elites are largely in denial, but of course not entirely, that's not true of the public. And opinion polls are amazingly consistent in both Europe and North America, including Canada, in indicating that 70% of the public in our countries regard political parties as corrupt, and a fairly similar figure regard parliaments and national assemblies as corrupt. So there's a misfit there between public perceptions and the position and policies adopted by those who are really running governments, as I say, with some exceptions. But how is this corruption manifested? And the guts of our argument and our book is in the following areas. First of all, party political finance. A lot of party political finance, and you might say all of it necessarily, but there are particular reasons to stress this, is really an investment for particular outcomes in public policy. So this is not, as it were, an objective and freestanding gift to a political party to perform as well as it can. It's linked to expected outcomes. And in the US, this is particularly important at the level of Congress, where political campaigns by both members of the House of Representatives and the Senate are very closely linked to campaign contributions, both from companies and indeed from civil rights organizations who expect particular outcomes. In the EU, during the last even 5 years, there have been many quite dramatic cases of illegal use of political finance in which both parties have benefited in one sense or another and individuals. And that's true whether we look at Italy, Spain, or France. And you may all have seen that ex-President Sarkozy is in trouble on that issue right now, just as is the leading candidate for centre-right, Fillon. Then the second area really is the lobbying industry. The lobbying industry is very well known, but most people don't have a clue how it really operates. In the US, this has been incredibly well documented, and you might describe the 13,000 registered lobbyists in Washington as hired guns pushing a particular cause. What is less well defined is the lobbying industry in Brussels, which is on an equal scale, also, as it happens, about 11,000 people who are the paid guns who are actually trying to influence legislation in some detail to the extent actually of drafting texts which ultimately end up before the European Parliament. And then multinational corporations, surprisingly unable to escape the corruption which has tarnished multinationals in the past. And although Many of us have been following very closely and trying to support developments in legislation which make bribes paid by multinational companies a criminal act. The impact after nearly 15 years of all of that is very mixed. So how is it that actually, and indeed in spite of the UK Bribery Act, we can have Rolls-Royce, GlaxoSmithKline in this country, Walmart in the US, and not so long ago Siemens in Germany, literally in the courts for using corrupt activities to further their brand. So we haven't quite escaped the extent to which multinationals are involved in this. And then in the banking sector, there are innumerable books, and I'm sure many of you have read, even perhaps most of them, about the banking crisis. But as a matter of fact, very few of them, and in fact I would argue almost none, really attribute any form of that crisis to different forms of corruption. But if you really examine, which we do in our book, the question of the ways in which that crisis came about, then you can see that forms of corruption were indeed in play. So there was a kind of nexus between contributions to the campaigns of individual congressmen and senators, I'm now talking obviously about the US side, the funding of lobbyists to ensure that regulation was minimized, the revolving door which ensured that people from, dare I mention it yet again, Goldman Sachs, played a key role in the then US government under Clinton and failed regulation. So the big issue of whether or not derivatives, which were, of course were at the heart of that financial crisis, could be regulated, was sidestepped by the Clinton administration, advised by Rubin and by others who actually, as it happens, had worked for Goldman Sachs. And this created the climate for subprime mortgages in which packages were securitized on both sides of the Atlantic, in which credit agencies rated them deliberately, overrated them, gave them AAA ratings, which they then adjusted within months. And the criminal activity, of course, which is rather a separate issue, but to do with management around Forex and interest rates. So we are arguing that the banking crisis can be seen as a form of corruption. Initially around 2010, that was a very controversial position to adopt, but since the banks have now been fined collectively more than $300 billion on both sides of the Atlantic, I think the courts have finally come around to accepting that. Linked to that, of course, is the question of offshore banking, which I won't go into in detail, but many of you will be familiar with the Panama Papers and all that has been revealed in that, and of course the role of the UK and US in the case of the UK, to the Caribbean centres like the British Virgin Islands and, of course, the Crown dependencies in the Channel Islands. But in the case of the US, which is less well-known, states such as Wyoming, Colorado, and Delaware, which have effectively operated as a base for anonymous companies. And the annual flows into these centres are a minimum of $1 trillion, and the stock of capital held there is at least 10 to 15 trillion, which makes it equal to half the assets of the US banking system. So that's a well-explored area, especially in recent months, so I won't talk about that just now unless you want to go into it. But that system, of which the UK is still an integral part, creates a huge incentive both to companies and individuals, not only for tax evasion, which is one thing, but for the fruits of manipulation of prices and, of course, of direct organized crime. And then we also look at issues like organized crime itself and the way in which organized crime is involved in drugs, that's well known, human trafficking, and counterfeit products. And I would say now a key area that is much less well understood is the marketing of pharmaceutical products through the internet, much of which turn out to be counterfeit or at least of dubious value. And there is a huge industry around that, which involves drugs being imported into this country following an order on the internet to avoid the usual limits that we have on the purchase of pharmaceuticals. And then in sport, there's the whole issue of why is it and how was it that an outfit like FIFA and before that IOC, and you could say with doping WADA, became so captured by interest groups basically for financial reasons. So the corruption of those entities that are supposed to be regulators is something that we look at very carefully. And then finally, on the environment, we argue that corruption is an underrated threat. to mitigation of climate change and the way in which regulatory authorities on both sides of the Atlantic have been subverted rather successfully by corrupt influences of one kind and another. Is there a link between all these themes? We think a good way of describing it is the buying of power and the selling of influence. So you can see how that works out and its significance. And Christine is going to talk now about individual cases which epitomize what I have been talking about in a more generic way.
Thank you, Lawrence. I have read the book, and as Lawrence's talk implies, it's not a very cheerful read, to be honest. But we will get a bit into what we can do about this problem later on. And Christine.
Perhaps the next 8 minutes or so won't be that cheerful either. So following on from Lawrence, I would like to give an example or give a few examples of the sectors that he has mentioned. I won't go through all of them. But one myth I would like to do away with in the beginning that seems to be persistent still is that corruption is a victimless crime and that in the end everybody profits from it and nobody really gets hurt. And I think we'll see that that certainly isn't the case. It's not the case in the global south where a lot of the corruption is about influence as well, but about classic bribery, but it certainly isn't the case here in the West either. Perhaps let me give you some examples from political party finance, from lobbying, influencing regulation, and one very classic bribery case to just demonstrate that. In terms of political party finance, I'm sure everybody or most everybody has heard about the Citizens United ruling in the US a few years back, which essentially said that secret donations can be made into political action committees. They can then support candidates, not directly. They can't liaise with the campaigns, but they can certainly funnel a lot of money into advertisement against certain candidates or for certain candidates and causes. And the impact that had was, I think, cannot be underestimated. It was a lot of influence of corporate people and corporations and what is sometimes called in the US the 1% of the 1%, so we're not even talking about elite, this is the elite of the elite, being able to now funnel a lot of money into causes. And that, of course, has influenced elections in the US to some degree and campaigns, certainly. And what is perhaps less known is that in the US, in 39 states, judges are elected. So this isn't only politicians being elected into Congress, but it's also judges. Since Citizens United also applies there, there has been a lot more money pouring into judicial elections, with the result that one investigation found that about 70% of the cases decided are in favor of the benefactors of these judges, and that certainly has a huge impact not only on the legislative branch now, but also how decisions are being made in courts. Certainly a very worrying development. Picking up from lobbying, as Lawrence has mentioned, it's a very broad spectrum. The one that I'd like to talk about is the revolving door phenomena, where we have influencers that move from one side through the revolving door to the next. It's something that we call corridors of power, where it's quite easy to move from the political sector into the corporate world and vice versa, or into lobbying firms or law firms in the US. So we've seen company executives move into government, and what was meant to serve as a mutual exchange, I think, has really served a lot of interests and knowledge exchange, but again, for a very small elite. On the EU level, these are striking numbers. About 50% of the members of the European Parliament move into the lobbying sector after their terms, and pretty much the same numbers are true for the US congressmen and women, and also for their staffers, which after a short cooling off period then can join the lobbying industry. And we've heard, I think every country has quite a few cases around that. In Germany, we had the former chief of staff of Ms. Merkel work as a chief of staff one day, and the next day he was the chief lobbyist for Deutsche Bahn, which is one of the biggest companies, our railway services. He was able to use the inside knowledge he had from government pretty much the next day. For that company, we've had the case of President Barroso moving again to Goldman Sachs, and four or five Goldman Sachs former executives moving into the U.S. administration. So there is that power exchange in a way. That is true for a lot of sectors where that is happening. Some sectors are more vulnerable than others or have more influence. We'll talk about pharmaceuticals in a little while, but certainly defense and construction are other sectors, or oil and gas where that is true, and banking. And that's very closely linked with the third point about influencing regulation. So where lobbyists have a sway over how legislation and regulation is being shaped, that of course has a tangible impact. One case we discovered was in France, where a pharmaceutical company, Servier, sold a drug for diabetes, which was then missold also for non-diabetic people as a weight loss drug. That led to serious health consequences, and the company managed to influence regulators to not take the drug off the market for quite a while. The drug was on the market in six countries in Europe, and led to arguably around 1,300 deaths over that time until it was finally taken off the market, when the EU put a stop to it and changed legislation that they could take it off the market. So you have very, very direct consequences of that sort of behavior as well. It's not something that doesn't have an impact. And then we have an interesting case of very cross-cutting classic bribery. The construction sector was a very, very interesting case in point there, because it often has links with organized crime as well. And this Quebec case that we were looking at certainly had that. There were about 100 people from both the organized crime world, a Casa Nostra crime family. You had people in the local administration that were in charge of contracts for buildings. You had political party finance that was linked with this. And over years, basically, this network managed to hold up a cartel of shifting contracts from one side to the other and not letting other competitors in. Now, of course, that led to a price increase for the local authority, but this network hugely benefited from that until it was discovered a few years back, and there was a huge investigation and a commission in Canada that looked into that. Now, that might not be very typical in Canada, but it certainly happens, and we've seen it in other countries as well, and it's a pattern that is repeated not only in Italy with construction, but also in other countries. In the UK, one of the recent surveys, for example, said that in the construction sector, that one-tenth of companies reported that they had lost more than $1 million due to corruption in the previous year. So it's something that affects the construction sector in the West very much. Now, that's all a bit grim. and where does that leave us, and what can we do? Now, we've seen in the corruption movement over the last 20 years that whenever you fight corruption, it really has a tendency to fight back. So it's not something that is easy to do. But if you cut it maybe into three points, one is kind of what needs to be done in terms of actions, what are the consequences that need to be seen, and who are the actors, then that perhaps helps in framing that that thinking. In terms of actions, we have seen a lot of legislative changes over the years. So in a lot of countries and a lot of sectors, actually, we have a good legislative framework. But there still needs to be more in terms of regulation, and companies certainly need to ramp up their compliance systems, ethics and compliance systems, and there needs to be more governance across the board. Or if you want to put it differently, this cult of secrecy needs to end, and there needs to be a kind of more coherent change towards transparency that is longer lasting. And that also includes things like offshore centers that Lawrence mentioned. And certainly there is popular support for that. If you've read the news recently that in Romania 100,000 plus people took to the streets to demonstrate against changes that would have infringed on that anti-corruption framework, there certainly is popular demand for that as well. In terms of consequences, I think it needs to be much clearer what happens when you go against the rules. And we haven't seen enough of that. So sometimes the low-hanging fruit get prosecuted, middle managers, small managers, but the CEOs rarely ever get touched. And so there needs to be much more in terms of enforcement. Some of the OECD countries are better than some others, but there isn't being done nearly enough on that front to actually be a deterrent of some sort. And in terms of actors, I think it's almost up to everybody to hold the people to account that we elect, to do more in terms of transparency, to make sure that these laws are being adhered to and that there is prosecution and enforcement, but also to amplify the voices of those that are already doing work on the ground. We've seen in the US now that the media is playing a big role in that, and that's certainly very helpful, but also very very necessary. As an outlook, I think the movement has come a long way in terms of pushing for transparency, but we've seen recently in the US how quick and easy it is to do away with some of that legislation. So very in the last few days, the rules around transparency in oil and gas, where contracts need to be published so that people actually know where that money is going. The US Congress did away with that rule, or is going to in the next days. It took years to establish that, as it usually does with policy changes. It takes a few days to get rid of it. So it means that perhaps the transparency idea isn't ingrained enough just yet, if it can be so easily taken away. And we'll talk about populism in a minute, but I think if we don't manage to get this more into the mainstream idea, then fringes on the far left and the far right will use this in their campaigning. And we've seen that in, not only in the US, but in a few other countries across Europe as well, that the anti-corruption is going against the establishment is used by people or by forces that we don't... That we'd rather not see in power.
Thank you, Anne-Christine. And is the book out, by the way? Is it available?
Yes, it's not only available, it's here.
Good. So I would strongly recommend people to read it. I mean, it is a bit grim, but it's very, very readable. And it was an eye-opener to me, actually. I had not been aware of how complacent I was about these issues. And I wonder whether, and this is my first question, and I'll leave you two to decide who is best equipped to answer each of the questions, but I guess I have in my mind this kind of distinction between kind of personal corruption, which is, you know, pay me 50 quid and I won't, you know, give you a parking fine or whatever it might be or whatever, and institutional corruption, which is more to do with structures and to do with the existence of lobbying industries and things like that. Is that distinction between personal corruption and structural corruption, is that a useful one?
Well, I think I'd rather like to answer that in relation to the developing world, where the debate about corruption is always one about petty corruption and grand corruption. So can we have a different set of values for the nurse in a hospital who's taking something on the side or a policeman on the beat and somebody at the level of a head of state who's taking millions into an offshore account? And there's a huge debate about that, whether or not you can really clean up petty corruption without cleaning up grand corruption and vice versa. So my own starting point would be that these two things are linked, because ultimately they're about ethics. But having said that, our focus and I think the issue that is really at stake in the West is the question of institutional corruption, because most of our societies, even in Europe and in the US and Canada, are not subject to day-to-day corruption of the kind that I mentioned in the developing world. So I think the question is the power of influence and, of course, the power of wealth, as we've been discussing, to influence institutions, which I think now we can see very clearly is extremely substantial. And I would argue myself that's a bigger issue, but I'm not sure you can really separate them.
We had a few years ago, we had a guy called Stan Cohen spoke in this room, actually, about a wonderful book he wrote called States of Denial, which is all about the way in which people justify bad behaviour. I'm kind of interested, Christine, how do you think people who are engaged in these forms of corruption, how is it they justify their behaviour? Is it kind of, well, everybody's at it? Or is it, well, this bit of corruption is in the end going to facilitate a good outcome, like more exports for our country or whatever?
I think there are a few answers to that. One we actually discussed on the way here, there was a wonderful book some years back called The System Made Me Do It, and I think that is part of that response where people say, and that is maybe particularly true for bribery and petty corruption, is where people say, but that whole system works like that, and I don't know how to get out of it, and that's certainly part of the answer. I think it eventually always undermines trust. So it's not, I think it's an easy out to say, well, the system just works like that, but it doesn't run more smoothly because of it. So
are we in danger, is popular culture in danger of normalizing this? I mean, it is almost impossible now not to watch a program about politics or about the police or about big business without the kind of background assumption that everybody's on the make.
Yeah.
Is that something we should worry about? That in a way, perversely, the people making those dramas might think this is about exposing evil in the world, but in a way what they're saying is, look, actually this is just how everything is. And so people entering into those areas might think, well, I guess that's what the convention is.
I mean, we've seen people going against that convention, but I think it comes back to that thing of trust, where people don't trust institutions or don't trust a particular sector, and corruption is one of the issues why that is the case. So you see corruption everywhere all of a sudden, and I think there is this kind of this unease of people where you say, well, maybe there is a disconnect between us and the people we vote for, or business, but certainly that plays a big role into it, where you see, oh, you know, there is this network of people that are all doing business, but it's got nothing to do with me. I mean, it might have an effect on me or an impact, but I don't really know how this is all working. It's a bit murky, and I think that's where transparency needs to go a long way to actually uncover what is happening and give people that trust back that they, you know, we can trust politicians or we can trust our businesses to do things in our interest.
It's part of the problem, Lawrence, that it's not clear when one's overstepping the mark. So I was asked by the Prime Minister to undertake a review of employment, which I'm doing. And much to my delight, a couple of weeks after I was appointed, I got text messages from people I hadn't spoken to for many years who happened to say to me in the course of, it must be great, you know, would be great to have a drink and catch up with you, that they represent, that they also ran public affairs companies that represented these gig economy platforms, which, by the way, if those gig economy platforms are listening, made me substantially more hostile to than I would have been if they hadn't employed these people. But nevertheless, it involved me actually being impolite to former friends who, you know, are quite nice people, really. But I had to say to them, I don't really want to see you. This is not the way to talk to me. Now, if I'd been polite and said, yeah, OK, I'll meet and let's have a chat, and if they'd then taken me out to dinner, and then if one of these companies had said, by the way, when you finished your review, we would love you to come and speak at our annual conference in Monte Carlo or whatever and talk about your review. The problem is, where in this process is, of course, the phrase I'm looking for. Thank you for that. Do you want to? Where in this slippery slope? Is the slippery slope the problem?
Yeah, but I'd just say two things. First of all, in relation to, are we in a kind of a new crisis? That probably is so, and I think we'd be prepared to argue that. On the other hand, cleanup campaigns with a degree of success have occurred, as it were, cyclically. So if you take the New York police, we show in the book that actually every 20 years since about 1920, the New York police has had a kind of corruption crisis and then gone into let's sort out our own house kind of mode of thought, which has had a considerable success, especially as it happens, I would say, right now. But I want to come up with a very boring answer in relation to the particular dilemma you've made, which is that there is such a thing as a code of conduct, and the world now is full of codes of conduct. But actually what's needed is not a code of conduct, it's actually the observation of that code. And I think it would be possible, even in this case, to have rules laid down which you could say to somebody, sorry, I can't see you because I'm subject to this particular code.
And certainly something we're seeing in companies, I mean, in you know, some of the better companies at least, where they have clear rules on, you know, who can invite whom and for which money, and that certainly helps some people as well to be able to turn that sort of offer down and say, you know what, actually, we can't do that.
I don't want to be obsessive lobbying, but is this, to a certain extent, is the lobbying industry the outsourcing of sin, in the sense that in a company, I'm not allowed to do this, but the lobbying firm, that's kind of what they do, so they are, and then I've got deniability if they overstep the mark.
Well, that's certainly, I mean, lobbying firms, but also if you have big industry associations, I mean, they have influence as well, and we show that, you know, there are quite a few with them, with a lot of influence. So I think then, if you were a company, you would have to draw that line and say, okay, well, if I meet with you, I meet with all of your competitors as well. So it's a two-way street, isn't it?
Just before we open up, thank you for giving me my daily dose of terrible things that the new president of America has done. I realised I'd got all the way to 1:30 without hearing anything, but the relationship here with populism, I want to ask you both about this, and two angles on it, really. One is the contribution that this kind of scepticism, cynicism makes, and the problem there, which in a way is that organisations like yourself, for the best possible reasons, almost contribute to this view. They almost contribute to the view that the elite is entirely corrupt and therefore we need some kind of new broom to come in. And then I'm secondly interested, given your breadth of experience, particularly yours, I guess, Orange, but the relationship between populism and corruption. Do populists, you know, who come in saying, I'm going to clean up, sweep up the stables, do they actually deliver on the whole? What should we expect?
Well, the last bit of the question is very difficult, but I think on the first bit, what I would say is that I find it remarkable, as a matter of fact, in the incessant coverage of populist parties, thinking now for the moment of Europe, but this may apply to the US as well, the extent to which well-informed journalists can discuss the five-star movement in Italy or Podemos in Spain or even Marine Le Pen without pointing out that actually they themselves are concerned about corruption. So we are fed a weekly or possibly daily dose of analysis of what's going on, which simply says they are disillusioned with their own governing elite without actually taking that any further. Although for the reasons I've given, even by looking at individual opinion polls, it's clear that the public do consider their governments to be corrupt. So I find there to be a disjunction of the way this thing is being covered. And actually, I think that it's, in a funny way, it's come out even more clearly in the US, where regardless of the day-to-day actions of Trump right now, the fact of the matter is that his slogan, drain the swamp, really caught on. And of course, it was echoed, if he's on the right, it was echoed by Bernie Sanders on the left, who was a major campaigner on the issue of the role of PACs and super PACs, which Anne-Christine mentioned. So I think that actually, in a way, the US is now ahead of Europe because we have had a campaign based on that issue and popularizing the issue. So I think that actually the coverage of all of this in Europe has to catch up with a kind of underlying reality about public opinion, and we can argue that in relation to Brexit as well. I think on the issue whether or not clean-up parties deliver, we have not yet seen a perfect case of that. And a good reference point is, some of you may remember, in about 94 and 95, in Milan in particular, but in Italy more broadly, there was a huge campaign called Manu Politi, in which a very leading magistrate in Milan, De Pietro, actually locked up. I mean, in the case of Italy, it's only for maybe a couple of nights, no less than 4,500 civil servants for taking bribes one way and another in municipal corruption. And he then became Minister of Justice for a while in Italy. But I don't think that most Italians today would say that actually that has had a lasting impact. So it's a very tricky question. I'm more comfortable, because we haven't really experienced this in a big way in Europe, I'm more comfortable answering this in relation to the rest of the world, where my star example is the AAM party in the state of New Delhi, run by Mr. Kejriwal, who actually was elected entirely on an anti-corruption ticket. That was his only platform 2 years ago. He's still in power, and he's now running candidates in other elections across India. And I think it's fair to say that he has done a fairly good job in Delhi, but not as good as he promised the electorate.
Before I read your book, I was complacent. After I read your book, I kind of thought I was surrounded by a miasma of corruption. How do you... When I worked in politics, what I saw was politicians struggling with the corruption, if you can call it that, of trying to balance pleasing the Labour Party, pleasing the Daily Mail. Now, I mean, that's a form of cultural corruption, I suspect, but not of the type you're describing. How do we describe this and get people to take it seriously without starting to believe that it is just normal practice?
I have two parts of that answer. I think it reminds me a lot of that discussion we have around the United Nations, where it feels like you can't criticize the United Nations because otherwise it feels like we need to do away with it, so right. You don't want to do that. And corruption is, you know, part of that discussion. But the other one is climate change, perhaps. I always feel like if we talk about corruption, it's like talking about climate change. I can't ask somebody, you know, you need to stop climate change. Please, like, can you go tomorrow and stop climate change? Nobody can do that. So we can talk about climate change or corruption as a big thing, but then we need to break it down. Then we need to say, okay, these are the different components, and these are the things you can be working on. So part of climate change is we'll have water shortage. Please turn off the tap when you're, doing whatever, brushing your teeth. And I see it very much the same way with anti-corruption, where we say, okay, there is a problem, it's corruption, and we describe it. But then we break it down into the different components, and then we say there's certain things that you can do about these components. And that is where, yes, it's a bit gloomy when you start, but I think that's where we need to do the explaining. And it doesn't mean that you can't do anything about it. We just need to start looking at the components and start putting it back together in a way that makes sense, so that people don't get disillusioned, say, oh, corruption everywhere. The big tidal wave is going to sweep us over, and that's it. That's certainly not where we're coming from. That's not what we want to do. We want to show that,
I think that's very convincing. Yeah, let's take some questions. We'll take three at a time.
Thank you. Picking up on your point about Di Pietro in Italy, I actually lived there for 10 years whilst he was in operation. My question is, what happens when the state is actually complicit with the individual? So to Matthew's point, state and individual. Italy is a great example of that. What the government would do would educate people to actually cheat the system. If you wanted to apply for planning permission to build an extension on your house, you knew it would take you years and you probably have to bung a bit of money to the local mayor to do so. And everybody knew that that's not what you do. What you do is you build it first and then you wait a couple of years, and the government is in such an economic disaster, it then retrospectively issues an amnesty. So what it's doing is educating the people not to follow the law, because you know you're going to be pardoned subsequently. So Di Pietro is up against an uphill thing when you're actually complicitly educating people not to do the right thing. The other example is Germany with Bernie Ecclestone. You have a law in Germany, I'm sorry that you do, which says if you are accused of bribery, then all you have to do is bribe the government with a larger amount, and you are effectively not guilty. And that's what he did. So when the state is complicit with the individual, how do you overcome that is the question.
I suspect we could spend the rest of the hour talking about that question, but thank you for that.
My name is David Alexander, and I work in the field of disaster risk reduction. And there is fairly convincing hard evidence that the principal cause of earthquake disasters is not seismicity, it is corruption. And this is a field in which we have a cure to damage ratio of 1 to 26, meaning that about 26 times as much money is spent on creating the disaster than is spent on ameliorating it. Critics, however, of that hypothesis would suggest that it all depends on your framework of analysis. And therein lies my question. I haven't yet read your book, though I shall. But I'm wondering what framework of analysis you use for situations in which the acid test is not realized. In other words, there is no prosecution for illegal activities because so much corruption is not illegal. It does not contravene any written rules.
Great, thank you.
Oh, hi. My name's Denise Green. I'm an interior designer. And I'm currently working with the EBRD Bank. Right. In London. I was a victim of organised criminals after I bought a flat in Highgate in 2001. And my eyes were opened in this country to the depth of corruption that is in this country, and it is very frightening. It took me 12 years to get away from those people, and a friend who was helping me was actually arrested. They tried to imprison him, and we were told, if you don't be quiet about the situation, they will find a jury to convict you both of something. We had our lives threatened. Financially, I was ruined by these people. I finally managed to get away from them, but there were individuals in Haringey Council, Haringey Police, solicitors, the courts, the Land Registry and the Land Tribunal. And I was absolutely astounded. And as a taxpayer, I found that the people who were actually being paid out the public purse in the councils and the police were working against me and for the organised criminals who obviously don't pay tax. And that's a really big concern. And that the people who impacted on my life are still walking free.
Can I talk about the Di Pietro case just for a moment? Yes, I can exactly see what you mean. and how that operates, and that you could describe that, and Italy is probably in that category, as a country in which corruption is endemic. So that then means it's actually in the same category as a lot of countries in much lower income situations around the world, as captured in TI's Corruption Perception Index every year. I think the evidence is actually that it's extremely difficult, as you're implying, to break that nexus. But it does depend on an individual and a small group of people being courageous enough to address it. So I was talking and you've raised the question of Italy. If you take the trial involving the so-called Maxi trial in Palermo in 1994, when 400 members of the Cosa Nostra and other mafia groups were in court, actually in cages very dramatically, you had a very courageous campaign by the prosecutors Falcone and Borsellini, who managed to get convictions against about two-thirds of those 400 mafia types. Has that had a favorable influence on Sicily? It's certainly not solved the problem, but I think all the indications are that that spelt the end of the high point of Cosa Nostra's kind of empire. So I think if you're really courageous about these things, and you're working in a way, in the case of those two very courageous guys, who, for those who don't know, tragically both got assassinated within 3 years, you can see that progress can be made. But I'm the first to agree it's very difficult. And there is I'm just supporting what you're saying. But there is a particular irony in Rome at the moment, because there is a case going on which you may be aware of, in which last year a group called June the 29th were found to be running a construction racket. The leader of that group was found to have, wait for it, 200 million euros in cash in his house. And Renzi, then prime minister, said, well, we're going to clean all this up. So the next stage was that it wasn't cleaned up. The five-star movement won the mayoralty of Rome. And the lady who is now the mayor of Rome then appointed somebody to deal with the corruption in the so-called eco-mafia dealing with waste products. And then that lady she appointed had to resign because the Italian press established that she herself had links with the eco-mafia that she was supposed to be cleaning up. So I have to admit that's a perfect demonstration of what you're saying, and I cannot pretend to be optimistic about an answer.
I'm kind of interested. There's another theme to that question, which is the relationship between incompetence and corruption. That is to say, in systems where you have to wait 8 years for your planning permission, you're much more likely to think, oh, sod this, I'll pay a bribe, than if it is done in six months. Is there a general relationship between the failure of the appropriate processes and the proliferation of corruption?
I would say yes. I would say whenever a procedure is non-transparent or doesn't work particularly well, and there is the opportunity, so there's always that correlation. Sometimes that happens, but there is no opportunity because it's just not possible to bribe anyone. But where those two come together and on that fault line between the citizen or public officials or companies and public officials, that is classically the way to circumvent that system, yes.
Move on to this question about how do we estimate the costs of transparency and the amount of money we ought to be investing in tackling it when it's not this transparency which ends up with the court case and clear evidence, but it's more systemic?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that comes back to a question of measurement, and that is inherently difficult. I mean, as you say, the impact is perhaps easier to see because you see how many buildings have come down because of shoddy construction, because the right procedures weren't in place or weren't kept. But estimating the cost of corruption to then say, okay, we'll spend 10% of that on the remedies is really, really difficult. You can do it on a sectoral basis, and we've tried that with TI UK, and you can do it across countries, but to arrive at the figure of how much corruption will cost across the board is, I would say, nearly impossible, and we need to spend more time in analyzing that to make a better argument of why it's actually cheaper to prevent it than wait until the building has come down and then build it up. And we can do that in individual cases, but that's...
We do know that systems with higher levels of trust are more economically efficient. I think
yes.
There is evidence to
that. And that comes back to the trust issue. So I think the corruption issue there goes both ways. The system is more efficient, and where people trust the system, there is more coherence there, and again, less likeness for corruption to try and circumvent the system.
And whilst we can't, and briefly, because I want to bring in another round of questions, whilst we can't comment on this...
Answering this
yeah, we can't comment on the individual case. I'm interested in this. Is corruption one of those things that it's not until you're kind of embroiled in it that you really understand it? You know,
I'm not sure about that. I think there are many good personal accounts of corrupt circumstances. There are very good analyses of individual countries. There's some terrific books about corruption in countries like Peru and Brazil, and a new one on the extent to which members of the Indian Parliament can be directly seen to be corrupt because they've been in court on criminal charges. That's to say 30% are the same. So I wouldn't really buy that.
I guess I'm talking about the complacency that we might feel until we find ourselves subject to a system which, either through explicit or structural corruption, we feel like this lady felt kind of the victim.
Oh, well, I think that's a completely fair point. I mean, most of us one way and another might well cave in, but I don't think that's an argument against the striving for a generic change. And there's, if I can answer that slightly differently, there is an excellent series of analyses of corruption in Russia by Elena Ledeneva, who's a senior person at the School of East European Studies at UCL, who herself is Russian, who's written 3 books on corruption in Russia. And her point, which to me kind of summarizes what I think you're getting at, Matthew, very well, is that it's possible to entertain in countries where corruption is endemic 2 thoughts. One, I don't want to do this. It's a terrible business. I've actually no desire to pay off this police officer to simplify matters. At the same time, I certainly want to see all this changed. And I think a big mistake that has been made, I'm now talking more globally than even Europe-wise, a big mistake that has been made in business circles, actually, in putting up with bribery throughout the developing world, is a view that this is actually what everybody likes. Everybody wants us to proceed this way, rather than accepting the fact that there are always 2 sides to the question.
Bruce Lloyd, I just want to raise a question, really, about the banking crisis. You mentioned the billions of pounds that have been paid by the banks in fines. This has not been paid out of the management bonuses. It's been paid by the taxpayer, the customers, and the shareholders. Isn't it about time we had an investigation into who really pays for these vast fines?
Okay, thank you. Yep.
How can we restore confidence and trust into the kind of public inquiries? I mean, I'll put the phone cracking scandal, for example. Okay, a few scapegoats, but a lot of institutional problems wasn't really dealt with.
Okay.
Tom Levitt. I understand that corruption trials can be very long and very complex and very use up a lot of resources, which is why big companies, I believe, have the option, if they put their hands up to corruption, to negotiate fines rather than go through the courts. My understanding is that that's what's happened in the recent Rolls-Royce case, but wasn't the Rolls-Royce case triggered by a whistleblower, in which case it shouldn't have been given that option? If that is the case, how do we take that further and put that right? Or is Rolls-Royce just too big to be found to be at fault?
And then there's 2 gentlemen here sitting behind each other, in front of each other.
Thank you. My name is James Sinclair. I'm a lawyer and social entrepreneur. My question is about the suspicious lacuna between policy and practice. Quick background, I spent 10 years living and working in the Middle East and South Asia trying to take vulnerable workers out of systems of corruption and exploitation. And it was very clear to me that when you follow the money back, it obviously comes back to large corporations and governments in the West. But the question is, what are they doing about it? And when you pick underneath the surface of the pretty policies, you find out that what they're doing is actually very little. And moreover, they are funding programs which are almost designed to fail. And so when you have people who come up with genuinely revolutionary ideas about things like supply chain transparency, they're overlooked by others who are essentially coming up with the same failed policies in a different colour.
Ramnik Shah, I'm a retired solicitor. You raised, Matthew, a point which I was going to raise about petty corruption and institutional corruption, the distinction between them. It's a moral maze kind of question. While there is a passive, it seems to me, there is a passive acceptance on a universal basis of corruption all around, the way it seems to me to break out of that cycle may be to have more prosecution. And under the Bribery Act 2010, we have now seen a number of them, and maybe that is the way to proceed.
Thank you. And then next year?
very quickly, Alan Saunders retired. Were the authors pleased or disappointed in the context of this conversation with the Brexit vote?
That's a bit of a bouncer for the end of the over of questions, if I can mix my cricketing metaphors. Just pick a couple of points that you want to respond to. First, you and Christine, and then Lawrence.
Let me start with the point of whistleblowing and whistleblower protection, because I think that's a really interesting one that cuts across a few of these areas. So as with Rolls-Royce, that has started with a whistleblower, and most of the big cases do. And in most countries, we have way too weak whistleblower protection in terms of retaliation against these people. So that certainly, that still needs a lot of addressing. The deferred prosecution agreements, or as I call them, get out of jail free cards, are certainly, they don't happen in all countries, but where they do, there is a very thin line to be walking to encourage companies to actually come forward and put in place better compliance systems, and quite often that's monitored, and that is good, but so quite often you can just pay out, and usually that's a fraction of the money you've won beforehand, so that certainly is a problem. So across the board, I would say whistleblowing protection is something that needs a lot more attention in these circumstances. And that is true for banking and other sectors as well, where some people have come forward. Wells Fargo in the US at the moment, one big case where people have come forward and there has been a lot of retaliation against them.
I'll pick up some of the other points. I mean, on this business of bonuses in the banking system and your key question, who pays? Well, I think it's very clear that these huge fines that have been levied, and the 300 billion figure is up to the end of 2015, and actually it seems to be very difficult to get a proper summary of the figure since then. But the fact of the matter is that those costs have clearly been met by shareholders, and the extent to which during the last 3 years the big banks have provided and assume they're going to be fined huge sums, several billion in each case, is just extraordinary. And obviously that's not at the cost of the CEOs or even the board, it's at the cost of shareholders. So I think it's fairly clear who pays. I think on the issue of caps, that's an idea whose time has certainly come, caps on bonuses. But we all know it's a bit tricky, because how do you qualify a bonus, and is it going to be a share, and how soon can you realize the value of the share, and so on. But I think in terms of who's paid, and what I would say, which I think is maybe of more value on that, is that it's still extraordinary the extent to which senior bankers have, quote unquote, got away with it. And it's amazing that somebody like Jamie Dimon is still actually the CEO of JP Morgan, I think. Yeah, and Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs. So that is an extraordinary fact. And we only seem in this country to be coming to terms with HBOS even now. And this issue lingers on. So there has been a complete failure, really, of the system to address this and the role of individuals. But I'm very clear as far as the shareholders are worthy, and this includes many, many pension funds, that they have been the losers. Then finally, well, on the Bribery Act, I just want to say that there are two things to be said about this. I mean, first of all, the Serious Fraud Office under the current director, David Green, seems to be reasonably serious about this. On the other hand, the total number of cases that have been brought under the Bribery Act involving international bribery, which in some cases can be within Europe as well as with the rest of the world, is still extremely small. I think you could say at the most a dozen over what is now about 5 years. So, yes, that rate of prosecution should be stepped up. But I have to say, not to defend the SFO, but because it's important information, that there are only four countries that are seen to be serious adherents of the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, and the UK is one of the four. So if we're one of the four, then, you know, the whole of the rest, for example, of the EU, apart from Germany, which is also in the top four, the whole of, let's say, that's 25 out of 27 are very badly in arrears. So, and then I think I'm bound to say something about Brexit, but it's much more important to hear what Anne-Christine has to say. But it's imperative that whatever we have so far achieved in anti-corruption legislation in this country, which is not insignificant, should be preserved, but more importantly, reinforced under Brexit.
You agree with that?
I would certainly agree with that, yeah. Very good. And then I have a whole personal opinion, but that would take up another hour.
That might be a future event.
Yeah.
So, Unmasked, which is a depressing but scintillating read, is available outside, and I'm sure that Lawrence and Anne-Christine, for a suitable undisclosed fee, we're happy to sign it for you. It's been a fantastic conversation, so can I just ask you to join me in thanking Lawrence Cockcroft and Anne-Christine Regan.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.